Welcome to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast, in conversation with the biggest names in sport, generating insight and engagement around coaching, officiating, and playing hockey. Presented by Jack Rolfe.
Norman Hughes, welcome to the European Hockey Institute podcast. Fantastic to have you again. Privileged to have someone that's been there, done it, got the t-shirt and the caps and everything to go with it. So we're incredibly grateful for your time. I'm going to make a few kind of bullet point introductions and maybe, Norman, you can fill in the gaps for me and share a little bit more. Started playing at 16, a little bit later than others, coming from football, a one club man for 18 years at Wakefield Hockey Club in Yorkshire. Been on both sides of the stick of playing for England, but also coaching for England. And a couple of Olympics and World Cups along that journey and many travel around the world. But what important details have I missed that you can share with us?
Yeah, I came from a little Cheshire town called Nantwich and went to Crewe Grammar. And Crewe Grammar, the two sports there for boys were football and hockey. Now, hockey's a girls' game, isn't it? You know, so the lads didn't really go near hockey to a great extent. They got a team out, but it was a struggle. And then when I was in the fifth form, the maths teacher, who, and he wouldn't get away with it nowadays, but the maths teacher said, young Hughes, you're not big enough for the team this year, for the football team. You know, basically go and get yourself a milk round or a paper round on Saturday morning. And I had, my best mate was a guy called David Swallow, and a prefect also who was head of school. And they nattered and nattered and nattered me for about 3 weeks to come and try hockey. And I resisted. I love my cricket. I really love my cricket at that stage. I was a county schoolboy. And so after 3 weeks of constant bombarding, come and have a go with us. Come and try it out. You'll enjoy it. I gave in to them. And obviously bat and ball, stick and ball, it clicked quite quickly and I started to enjoy the sport. Strangely enough, David Swallow ended up being an international umpire until his school career as a headmaster in South Wales took over. But David toured Australia with the England team in 81 and did many international games. He's probably a bit too nice for a top umpire, if you know what I mean. Not the edge to it that means player control when it got really hot and all that, but an unbelievable mate. So that's how I got into hockey. And whilst you sort of class me as a one club person, actually, I started my hockey at Crewe Vagrants, obviously the local club. One of the PE teachers pushed me there and said, you need to play some club hockey as well, young man. And then when I was going for England schoolboy trials, a guy called Jeff Poole, who was a GB and Welsh international, based up at Neston at Caldy Grange School, he talked long and hard to me and said, you know, to be frank, you're not getting good enough hockey and you're not playing on good enough surfaces. Bear in mind, we're on grass pitches and at Crewe Vagrants, if you leaned into the right winger, he ended up in a hedge in a ditch, you know. So I was cajoled into joining Winnington Park. They played in the then Northwest Premier League against, you know, the Bowdens, the Brooklands, the Hightowns, the Liverpool Seftons, all top clubs in those days, producing internationals for England, Great Britain and Scotland. But the main benefit, as well as playing at a better level, was the pitch at Winnington Park was just like a bowling green, like a snooker table. It was ICI owned and it was just a wonderful, wonderful surface. The other great benefit we had, it was next to the ICI chemical works. So if we went 1-0 up at half time, we just had a word with the foreman and he threw a sulfur cloud over our goal, which meant that nobody wanted to go anywhere near our 23-meter line. You know? But yeah, Winnington, wonderful times. And I joined Wakefield after playing for Leeds University. Wakefield was my first really senior club. You know, when I was a senior player. So I would be sort of 21, 22 when I joined Wakefield straight out of university. And that's when, since then, yeah, I've been a one-man club. So I've done the best part of 45 years there now. Yeah.
Magical. And did you play hockey like you played football? That transition, did you just replicate it with a stick in your arms?
Yeah, I call the sports are very, very similar in terms of movement off the ball, supporting your teammate and offering a pass and all. Very, very similar sports. Obviously, we've got no offside now, but in those days, they're extremely similar sports. So I approached it, you know, hockey's football with a stick, or football's hockey without a stick, you know, and that's how I approached it, really. It was all about supporting the guy in the ball because you wanted the ball. You know, you played to get hold of the ball and do something with it.
And I guess the interesting part here is, and something when we speak to every guest that's been there and played at the top level, that they can name that first experience that almost set them up for life in a way. Their first experience or the first teacher or their first coach played such a pivotal role and gave them such an opportunity and great experience that they continue to be involved for many, many years. And I always say to coaches, you never want to be somebody's last hockey coach. You know, you never want to be the last person to introduce that. So what did you take into your coaching from those first experiences? Because that obviously would have been such a positive experience to keep you in the game for so long.
I hope an honesty, you know, giving players honest feedback and you know, so honest messages. I hope it was honesty because I suppose the guy who really set my career up, well, there were two guys, actually, Jeff Poole and Peter Cross. They were both teaching at Caldy Grange, and Peter was heavily involved in England schoolboys. He told me a story, actually, when I went over to Winnington Park for their 50th anniversary or whatever. And he said, Hughes, he said, what you don't realise is I threatened to walk out of the England schoolboys selection meeting. I said, what do you mean, Crossy? He said, they weren't going to pick you, mate. He said, they decided they weren't going to pick that young Northern lad, he said. But I said, if you can't see what I see, I'm wasting my time here. And he got up to walk out. So I suppose without Peter Cross and that champion, who knows whether I would have made it or not, to be frank. And Pooley was a very skillful, through a 50-yard aerial, very skillful Wales and Great Britain player who taught me several things in terms of control of the ball and that, which was very influential and very important.
So from starting at 16, those first 5 years would have accelerated quite quickly to suddenly being a first-time hockey player, to being in a schoolboys environment and mixing with people outside of your area.
Exactly. And the university period was very influential. I played for Leeds University and got into the UAU teams. Another guy I must mention is Trevor Clark, because before I went to Leeds University, they'd seen me play for Cheshire Schoolboys, and the UAU invited me to Lillishall for a summer camp. People like Mike Hamilton were on there and various other people. And Trevor was the coach with a guy called Terry Podesta from the Midlands. He was a dentist, but very closely linked to Birmingham University at that stage. And that week was very influential in me being talent spotted, if that's the right term, you know. And Trevor remained an unbelievably close friend until we lost him a few years back.
And did you get in first time, Norman? What was that first trial like?
There was no second trial in those days, Jack. It was you legged it to St Albans. You played your matches on, I think it was Clarence Park. And then I'll tell you one thing I remember, which I'll share with people, which still niggles me to this day, but in a positive way. The chairman of selectors was the headmaster of Kingston Grammar School. And he was reading the squad out that had been selected to go over to Itzehoe and play against Germany, and to Bloemendaal and play against the Dutch, and then to Port Talbot and play the home internationals. And he sort of said, so-and-so, Haberdashers Asks, so-and-so, Kingston Grammar School, so-and-so, Millfield School, Norman Hughes, who Grammar School? And his tone, I can remember to this day, so there was a change in his tone as if, do Crewe Grammar School play hockey? And I thought, bugger you, mate, I'll show you whether Crewe Grammar School play hockey or not. Funnily enough, a year after me, a young guy called Joey Middleton also got into England schoolboys from Crewe Grammar School. So But that stayed with me forever. And I thought, and today, you know, as a sport, we don't do a good enough job encouraging talent from state schools, because state schools haven't got the money to afford hockey equipment. And as a sport, if we want to be inclusive, we're doing a pretty poor job. I know there are now programs in place, but over the years, we've done a pretty poor job at making sure that hockey isn't just for the privileged independent sector.
And I guess whilst we're on it, it's quite a topical discussion, I guess. And it's something I always believe is hockey, you have to have a sport, you have to have a stick in your hand to play it. Whereas soccer, rugby, you can throw a water bottle, you could throw anything to, or kick anything to play it. And I think one of the biggest barriers is actually just having the sticks in the hands of young people to open their eyes to the sport.
Absolutely, yeah. And you and I know we don't need a goalie and £500 worth of kit. We can have a great game with just three or four players aside and get on with it. Have a bit of fun, guys, you know.
And Norman, I'm sure you would have played on some rather alternative surfaces during your time
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. We played at the Army Apprentices Ground in Harrogate, tarmac. You remember the old shale pitches where if you fell over, you were absolutely no skin anywhere. We played all sorts, really. I remember playing on the parade ground. Well, not the parade ground, but it was their national stadium in Gibraltar. That was shale in 40 degrees of heat. And that was quite a challenge with their home umpires and all that. Yeah, to be honest, it was a very, very interesting period of hockey's development, because we went from natural grass in the World Cup in Bombay and the World Cup on the Polo Grounds in Argentina in 78 to AstroTurf from Montreal onward. So it was a very interesting period, and I feel quite privileged to have played on those different surfaces at international level. You know, it certainly taught you to watch the ball onto the stick. It certainly taught you to concentrate on the first touch.
Yeah, and whilst I guess if we bring this area to a bit of a close, is that the challenge we've set all the listeners in terms of the coaches would be, you don't need an AstroTurf to play the sport. You don't need the best stick in the world. You just need some sticks.
And some passion.
Absolutely. Beautiful. Let's move on to, I guess, a full circle from starting as a schoolboy to going to a World Cup, being at the Olympics, going to be on the other side to be the coach. What do you recall and remember from that senior international experiences?
It was a wonderful time. My first real tour, we did a sort of four or five nations in Amstelveen, but my real tour was to India in 77. And we flew out to Bombay, got on a train to Madhya and Andhra Pradesh in the middle of nowhere in India. And we were playing on baked clay with scaffold stands with 20,000 people cheering the local state teams on. We were playing state teams at that time. England Hockey had tried to arrange a five test series against India, but they hadn't really firmed anything up. It was all a bit too loose. So when we got out there, the manager, Ian Taylor, not the then goalkeeper, the manager Ian Taylor from Bowden, he found that we were playing the state of Madhya Pradesh, the state of Andhra Pradesh, the state of Punjab. We weren't playing the Indian national team at all. So that caused the senior pros in the team to sort of get a bit stressed. But for young lads like me, I was 23, 24. It was unbelievable. It was fabulous, just the travel experience, let alone the hockey experience. And to see 20,000 people come to a stadium that we'd walked to the day before and found ladies patting mud into the divots, you know, into the areas that needed a bit of attention and hardening the mud with their hand and that. It was just great times, really. About half of the squad went down with stomach complaints during that trip. One no less than the then captain and the future GB captain and manager, Bernie Cotton. When we got to the YMCA in Delhi, he lost his head a little bit. He'd had enough. He wanted to get home. And he sort of banged the table, which was not good, really. But he banged the table and said to the waiter, "I want the hottest curry you can bring me." Well, he got the hottest curry that guy could bring him. And we never saw Burnley for 3 days after that. He was in his room coming round. So he missed the last two games in the Nehru tournament out there. Argentina, we played on the polo grounds. The grass was quite long, to be honest with you, so you really had to put a fair bit through the ball to make it move distances, you know. And it had rained very, very heavily before the World Cup, so that didn't help the preparation of the local organising team. And then Bombay, where we played on the 81 World Cup, where we played on the outfield in the National Cricket Stadium there. And we made the mistake then. FIH, first of all, made a mistake. The tournament started just before New Year. And obviously, half of our squad were family men. And really, to acclimatise, you needed to be there 6-7 days before. But that meant that you weren't home for Christmas with the family. So we had a vote after squad training. And unanimously, the squad decided, I was captain at that stage, we decided to go out after Boxing Day. We couldn't run for the first two games, the humidity, we just hadn't prepared properly. So we were out of the tournament with two games down just because we'd basically ring-fenced Christmas for the family and got out there too late. By the time we got out there, Australia were there, Holland were there, Germany were there, and we had no legs in the first two games. But that scheduling was ridiculously silly, really, to expect players to be playing over New Year. Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. What was that moment, Norman, where you've gone from being a schoolboy playing a totally brand new sport to being a senior international to think, actually, this is amazing. There is opportunities. I'm travelling. I'm good enough to be at this level.
Yeah, I think I started to belong during, you sort of finding your way into a senior squad, and very southern based, as it obviously most of the hockey core is southeast, and the numbers are there, so that's understandable. So I suppose I really started to belong during that India tour. I think I felt, this isn't a short journey I'm on. I'm here for a few years. I'm not in and out after a year because, people have overtaken me. I'm sort of here to stay. I think that gave me a hell of a lot of confidence. A, because I remained fit. I didn't get any tummy problems. And B, because of, I felt as if my standard of play was such that, I felt, I can crack this. I can crack this, and I belong here. And you get a sense for your teammates, don't you? Whether you're a core player or whether you're a fringe player, et cetera, et cetera. I know with the rolling subs on and off now, it's totally different. But in those days, you certainly got a feel as to whether you were a core start player or whether you were a bit of a sub with 15 minutes to go type of player.
So debut in 77. 77. In 76, GB didn't qualify for the Olympics. And in 80, it obviously got boycotted, which was, maybe you can share a little bit of insight on that. Because were those conversations like? How late was it to you? How late did you know?
Oh, as a squad and as a management team, to be fair, we were fighting to the last minute because the story that went round, as players, you're never 100% close to it, because your governing body is in negotiations with the government, et cetera, et cetera. But it was obvious that Margaret Thatcher's government didn't want sports to go to Moscow, even though the riders and the runners and all that were going. And I was on the Frost programme, big sort of programme at that stage, basically lobbying to say, we understand that sports and politics can't be totally separated. But what harm can we do by going? Surely if you keep a bit like Ukraine at the moment, if you can keep dialogue going, you've always got a chance. If you just separate yourself off completely, what chance is there of any compromising coming together in the future? So we argued that for a long, long time. And that was really bitterly disappointing, because I think that squad of 1980 could have done well in Moscow. I know all the plaudits are given to 4 and 8 years later, 84 and 88. But that squad of 1980 was a very strong squad, which could have got into semi-finals and who knows. So it was a bitterly disappointing time. And I know for several players who were closer to the end of their career than I was at that stage, I was 26, I think, and 28. And it ruined them completely. You know, it was the end, no more Olympics for them. So it was a bitterly sad. And the deal was supposed to be, if you don't go, we'll build you a national stadium. Well, we're still waiting. You know, they did, obviously, for London 2012 and all that, and Milton Keynes after 86, but they didn't honour their pledge for 1980. There was no sort of stadium built 2 or 3 years later for hockey at all. So my message is never trust the politicians.
Maybe something good to live by. And obviously, after that period where some would have come to the end of their career, and almost like the current game now, the end of an Olympic cycle, people clear out, and I guess you would have probably stepped up again to become an even more senior player than you were. And talk us through those next years after that, going into the next Olympics.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was made captain, and you know, that brought more responsibility. We started to with Trevor Clark's and Roger Self's help and Colin Wally's the leadership. We started to put a really good group together, a really strong group together. Hounslow as a club were having success in Europe, and you know, that generated quite a lot. And Slough with Ian Taylor, Paul Barber, etc. So we started to develop a really good, strong unit. And I think also the tours that we did to Australia really toughened us up, hardened us up, and brought us together as a squad in terms of real team spirit, because of the time we spent together. You know, 4 weeks in Australia going all the way around the continent was a real bonding exercise. So all credit to Colin Wally, who shoved us in the back of a white van in Liverpool and said, run to Bissam Abbey and raise £8,000 and I'll take you to Australia. And the squad did. You know, we did five-mile stints each. So myself, Malcolm Wilkinson, and Imran and all that got in a little white van with foam on the floor in Liverpool, and we legged it to the Midlands, and then the Midlands group took over, then the Southern group came up and took it through to Bissam Abbey overnight. And that, I say, that raised us £8,000, which meant we could afford to go to Australia. We never quite managed the extra £2,000 to get further on to New Zealand, unfortunately. That's a great regret of mine, that I've never visited New Zealand as a player. But obviously Australia in those days, as now really, were the team to beat. Massive, massive talent, great skill, really tough opponents. Just the enjoyable games you like to play, you know, because it was raw, it was hard, it was aggressive, but full of skill as well.
Definitely, what a great rivalry. And then if we skip on a few years, you retire in 86 after a wonderful career. And quite a special career coming from where you did, even to this day, coming from a state school. And then talk to us about the transition from being a player to then being on the other side and becoming the coach. Was there always aspirations to become a coach? What did that look like?
Yeah, during the latter stages of my playing career, I'd got involved in coaching at junior level for the club. And obviously, again, in those days, being an influential player within a club like Wakefield, you did quite a lot of coaching midweek as well, as a player coach type role. It was difficult. As a player, I'd always been a straight talking, no nonsense, you're not pulling your weight, Curly, pull your finger out type of leader. So I suppose I had a little bit of distance with the players in terms of respect because of the leadership role that I'd had. But it was difficult because basically I suppose I was fortunate that Dave Whittaker gave me the England development squad. It was England B then, it was called, but England development squad for a couple of years while he took the squad to the Olympics, etc. So that gave me 2 years of working with top players on the coaching ground. But I enjoyed it, but it was very, very challenging and really bloody hard work. The preparation involved making sure that training weekends were really motivating to the group. It was very hard work. I enjoyed most of the part. I had some lows. My main low, I suppose when we went out to the Olympics in Barcelona with GB, I'd set myself a sort of results target rather than a process target. And I felt that the squad we had was good enough to be in the top five. And the only regret I had from Barcelona was losing to Spain in the final game and finishing sixth. In the pool games, we'd played Australia, best team in the world, in my opinion, at that stage. And we played Germany, and Germany put us away 3-1. So I had no regrets about the pool results. We'd beaten India, we'd beaten Argentina, we'd beaten New Zealand, etc. So teams ranked around us and below us, we'd put away. We hadn't slipped up. We'd not taken a scalp, as it were, a higher ranked team. But I came away from Barcelona really disappointed that we hadn't protected our Champions Trophy status and finished in the top five. That was my biggest regret from coaching at that level, that the squad, we didn't manage that.
What would be some fond memories that still give you a smile to this day?
Yeah, again, touring Australia with the squad, and none of the Southgate players had been able to join us on this tour because they had European club commitments and all that. And we played Australia and they'd put us away 7-1. And I was walking off the pitch and Jim Irvine was coaching Australia at that stage. And some idiot from the crowd shouted to Jim, "Hey, Jim, what time's the game start tomorrow?" And Jim said, "Oh, about every 5 minutes." Because they put seven goals past us, you know. Thanks, Jim. So, yeah, touring Australia, and I just find it a wonderful place to be. People are straightforward with you. You know where you stand. And, well, you live there now, you know, don't you? It's just, they're just a great, they're my type of people. Don't take any SHIT. They're just my type of people.
And I think a personal reflection for me would be that they often don't identify themselves as hockey players. They've often got a job outside of hockey. So it's not, I am a hockey player, it's I'm a student that's playing hockey, or I'm a nurse that's playing hockey. So it's much more of a holistic outlook, I think, as well.
More rounded people, perhaps, eh? More rounded, complete people, because, yeah, I really struggle with this centralised programme in England and GB. It may be bringing us medals, but it's pulled out of the core of our sport the biggest and brightest talents. And how can we inspire a young lad at Doncaster if Barry Middleton doesn't play for Doncaster? You know, I suppose one of the, I don't want to sound arrogant here, but one of the reasons why I never moved to London, and several people said, you've got to go down to London to be in the squad and play against the best players and all that. Maybe, but what about the kids you leave behind in your club and the kids you leave behind in other clubs who come and watch their team play? You know, if you can't give the legacy of them seeing an international player in Yorkshire, in Cheshire, in Worcestershire. And I think that is the real downside of a centralised programme. It may bring you medals if that's the only thing you're interested in, medals. Very difficult to argue against it. But I think it pulls out of, the hockey family pool, that talent. And yeah, people can leg it to Lee Valley and to, other stadiums in London. But how many young kids are actually going to do that compared to seeing an England, a GB, a Welsh and a Scottish international play on their patch in their region? That's what worries me about centralised programmes. There's got to be a better way of doing it, a better mix, in my opinion. Whether that's franchise clubs in different regions of England. You know, I don't know, but there's got to be a better way. And if you're after more rounded characters, I'm not sure about putting them in one place all the year together. Does that create rounded characters? Well, jury's out for me, Jack, really is.
And related it to a rugby scenario, I think it was Johnny Wilkinson came out after the World Cup when they won, and he said, okay, it's been great, we've been in this environment, but what do I do now? They achieved the aim, and that's exactly what they set out to achieve, but they were in such an environment that there wasn't the outside world in his life at that moment. And when he left, he didn't really know what he was doing or where he was.
I'm sure of today's players are in that situation, and I find that very sad. And we can't go back to my era where we had doctors, we had engineers, we had teachers, we had sales and marketing management, etc. You can't go back to those days because obviously the demands on the modern player are far, far higher in terms of time and commitment. But there's got to be a balance that means, you know, they can have a more rounded existence, I think. Otherwise, they end up, as you say, what do I do now? I've put my stick away. Where do I go now? And most of them end up in independent schools coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned motivation and energy when you was coach and when players were coming for the weekend. And a more wider question, what does it look like to best motivate and give energy to young people, to the 15 player, to whoever that might be? How does the coach give energy and motivation to a session?
I think by demanding high intensity, that you train as you play, you know, so it isn't a training weekend, you're actually playing internationals over the weekend, squad games. But some of the toughest games we played were the squad games where Group A and Group B knocked hell out of each other. And that really took us up a level because, you know, you were fighting for your place, and B, you were trying to prove that, you know, you were right up there in terms of the group hierarchy and that. So the intensity, and I think, again, the honesty of saying, you know, guys, have we in that session, did we deliver the type of quality, the type of intensity, and did we hit the aims that we set together? Did we actually hit the targets we'd set before that session started? Are you happy that you're now a better player at the end of that 45 minutes than you were at the start? You feel that you've progressed? If so, you've just wasted 45. If so, you've benefited from that 45 minutes. If you haven't, we've just wasted 45 minutes of everybody's time. So it's the honesty and the demanding, and it comes best if it comes from the players rather than being coach-led. If the players themselves stop a session and say, guys, this isn't good enough, come on, let's up it a notch. It comes, if the messages come from within the group, it's far more powerful than a group bellowing from the touchline. And that's the message, sorry to be regional, that lots of coaches in Eastern Europe need to learn, that it's not about bawling from the touchline. It's about empowering the players to be leadership figures.
And that's a scary feeling for a lot of people, isn't it? To actually, because there's this feeling of what the perception of a coach is, I must shout, I must demand, whereas actually a coach maybe is nowadays to facilitate and inspire.
Yeah, you're a teacher, aren't you? And you're trying to make the athletes better players, all round better players in terms of their leadership skills and their skill set and their decision making. So you should take pride in that and not feel threatened if they take ownership of a session. You should sit back, in my opinion, and then say, not doing a bad job here. These guys are really learning now. You can see it. These guys are taking ownership. They're taking responsibility. They're making decisions.
And when you play in front of 20,000 in India, the coach, you probably can't hear the coach anyway, can you?
No. 70,000 in the Champions Trophy in Pakistan and 20,000 in India, you can't hear anything other than the crowd, no. So, no.
Yeah, definitely. I've wrote down two reflections here, Norman, of one, be true to yourself, and the other is be inspirational. As my two reflections from this conversation.
I think they're very good, very good messages for anyone in any sport, to be honest with you.
Norman, thanks so much for your time. One, I'm incredibly grateful for your time to come and do this, but the wider inspiration to those that you have impacted, not just in the UK, but with the work of the EHF and much further beyond?
Yeah, that was some of my most, to be honest, the Coaches for Europe and the Top Coaches Programme, to see people coming through that now and beyond. You know, it's really nice to see Bernardo Fernandes and where he's ended up and people like that, and to see Michelle Kinnan still working in the coach education area alongside Herman Cruyff, and that's really rewarding to see how that's progressed.